Good. So we are currently in the chapter, and that's the last package of the lecture. We talk about image fusion and registration. And we look at the rigid situation, rigid registration, where we just allow for rotation and translation, but no deformation. Deformations will be considered in summer semester in interventional medical image processing. We look at rigid registration, and Dieter has just shown to you a video where you have seen how, for instance, the skull is rigid, registered using an MR and an CT image. And registration means compute the transformation such that both data sets or multiple data sets end up to sit in a joint coordinate system. And fusion is the process of computing the transform and visualizing the multimodal data set. Yeah? Fusion means bring them all together and visualize it. So it's a little more in terms of expressing the situation. Good. And last week, we ended the chapter on point correspondence-based registration, where we use features, points, point correspondences, and compute out of point correspondences the transformation, the rigid transformation. For the 2D, 2D case, it's a linear estimation problem using complex numbers. For the 3D, 2D estimation problem, it's a linear problem using homogeneous coordinates. And for the 3D, 3D point cloud registration, it's also a linear problem using quaternions. Okay? So that was the big picture that we now have in mind while thinking about point-based registration. Then on Thursday, we looked at intensity-based rigid registration. And the steps for this is as follows. What do we have to solve? First of all, we need to define a similarity measure. That means you take the original image, you take the target image, you map the two images using transformation T on each other, and then you have a number telling you how well the two images fit to each other. Yeah, similarity measure. We will talk about this in a few minutes again in more detail. Once we have a similarity measure, we need to parameterize our transformation. We have to characterize what is the type of transformation we look at, and then we basically define our search space. So, define the parameterization of the transform. I will give you a few examples then. And then, you get a similarity measure, you incorporate the parameterization of the transform, and then you try to optimize or to maximize the similarity, or the dissimilarity has to be minimized in terms of in terms of the parameters, and then you have to walk through the search space, and you have to find the extreme values of your similarity measure. And what's important in this context is the optimization algorithm. The optimization algorithm that has to be considered. And if you know these three steps, then you are basically set up to implement a, let me just switch that off, to implement a op, registration routine. Let me just try to switch that off here. So let's use an example. How can I switch that off? Let's look at the registration of two CT data sets first. Okay? So we have one two. So this is our source image, and this is our reference image, or that's another name for the image pair. We call this R, and this we call S. And then we need to have a transformation T. And we look at the first step, the similarity measure. And here we have seen on Thursday that we can use SSD, sum of squared differences. That means we look at in the discrete at the sum over all ij, and then we look at s at position ij minus r at position ij and take the square of it and look basically how much the intensities of assigned pixels differ from each other. Yeah? The smaller this value is, the more similar are the data sets. Yeah. Second step. The parametrization. Well, if we consider rigid transformations, our parametrization is more or less clear, Stefan. It's a six-dimensional search space, and The transformation is given by a rotation and translation. Yeah, rigid transformation is given by a rotation and a translation. And basically, we have 6 degrees of freedom. Yeah, 6 degrees of freedom. So we have to search in a six-dimensional space, okay? We have to search in a six-dimensional space. And now Tobias is saying, no problem. Six-dimensional space, I mean, that's something I think I can manage. Yeah? A six-dimensional space, I think I can manage to search in a six-dimensional space. So optimization. So what we have to do is we have to estimate the rotation and translation. And due to the fact that I have called the second image reference image R, I call the mapping we are estimating A plus T or B. Yeah. So we have to minimize the sum over ij, Sij minus R. And then we take the transformed index ij. So we rotate the second volume. So if I want to know where does the point ij end up in the second image, I rotate and translate the second transform that is given by the transform t. And I minimize this here with respect to the degrees of freedom of t, and this degrees of freedom of t are in this case 6. Okay? How would you optimize this? What would you do? Doesn't matter. Well, from a theoretical point of view, that doesn't matter. Actually, there is always, if you discretize things, a difference. So people are thinking about transforming both this and this into a joint coordinate system that is not one of the other or the other. There are methods that look for a transformation by extending the objective function, saying this one transformed has to be as similar as this one, and this one transformed with the inverse of this one has to be like this one, and they combine the two SSDs. So there are many, many ideas out, but that's delta epsilon research. Yeah, that's not the key insight that we need to get within the lecture. Yeah, you can refine these things and do experiments and do this a little bit and this a little bit, and you will gain some minor progress for certain applications, yes. But for the big story, this is for us now sufficient, okay? But a good question. How would you optimize this function? Oh, come on. Yeah, but what you do is here, you have your grid, yeah, and you have here your ij, and you transform the ij by the transformation. And the question is whether you will end up, if you use this intensity-based approach with a linear solver. Actually, you won't. So what people do is decide on a representation for the rotation, for instance, axis angle, or the Euler angles, or quaternions, and then search in the space of your parameters. That means you try to find the minimum of this function. And what you can do is you can compute the gradient, for instance, numerically, and then do a steepest descent method. Or what you also can do in this case, in a six-dimensional space, is the so-called grid search. That's what we usually do is, let's look at the 1D search situation. So look at the following. You have, illustration. You have here your x, you have your function you want to minimize, and the function goes like this, okay? And you look for the global minimum, the global one. So you have many, and you look for the smallest value the function can get. And what we do is either equidistantly we sample the x-axis. In our situation, we sample the 6 coordinate axes equidistantly, and then we evaluate the function. Yeah. And then either we decide for the minimum, or what we usually do is we look where we end up here. And at these points, we start a gradient descent. Yeah. So we look at all these points, and we start a gradient descent, and we end up in these 3 minima, and then we decide at the end for the global one. If you have a finite or a reasonable number of degrees of freedom, you can do that. But the curse of dimensionality is an issue. The curse of dimensionality is an issue. So think about our situation. We have 3 rotations around the x, y, and z axis. And think about, we have a 1 degree discretization of the axis. So we have 360. Or let's do the computations in powers of 2. Yeah, yeah. I'm a computer scientist. 350. What's that? 360. Sorry, 360. What's that? Yeah. Okay, it's 36 is a square, but square number. But let's take 256. Okay, 256 is 2 to the power of 8. Yes, 2 to the power of 8. So we have 2 to the power of 8 times 2 to the power of 8 times 2 to the power of 8 samples, and that means 2 to the power of 24 function evaluations. Yeah, so I have to evaluate the function 2 to the power of 24 times. Yeah, that's roughly 10,000 function evaluations. Okay? Roughly 10,000. Roughly. Am I right? Yeah? 2 to the power. No, no. Oh, sorry. It's way more. It's not 2 to the power of 11. Yeah, 14. Yeah, 24. 2 to the power of 24. Yeah, so it's 2 to the power of 10. 2 to the power of 10 times 2 to the power of 4. Wow, that's quite a number. Yeah, that's it's recorded. So the conclusion of today's lecture is good that he stops teaching. Yeah, that's what I wanted to hear. And then let's think about 3 translations. Three translations, and let's say we have 1,000 in each dimension. So we have 2 to the power of 10 times 2 to the power of 10 times 2 to the power of 10 evaluations for t. So in total, we have 2 to the power of 10, 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 2 to the power of 10 times 8 function evaluations. Yeah. So that's 1,000 by 1,000 by 1,000 by 1,000 by 1,000, and that 8 times. And then you can imagine, I mean, to evaluate the similarity measure for one parameter setting, that means you have to run over all the voxels. Yeah, if you have a 1k by 1k by 1k volume, the function evaluation will take half a second. Yeah, and the grid search, you can imagine, if you do the evaluation that many times, you wait forever. So rigid image registration is not as simple as people feel. Yeah, it's a tremendously difficult optimization problem, actually. And we apply many tricks. One trick, for example, and I have this on the slides of the last lecture, is that we do not go over the volume, the complete volume, but we take only a subset of voxels, and we randomly choose the voxels. And Dieter Hahn, who was with us at the beginning of the lecture, he was able to show that you get very good results if you just take 0.1% of the voxels randomly and optimize the objective function. The only thing is that within each optimization step, so if you, for instance, do the following, if you decide to evaluate the function here, you take just 1% of the data to get this function value. Then you compute the gradient and you evaluate the function at this point. To evaluate the function at this point, you have to change the pixels you use for computing the similarity measure. So you randomly compute another set of voxels that you use for similarity computation. You compute the gradient, you evaluate, and again you evaluate for another randomly chosen subset of voxels. And the interesting thing is that this randomized process implies the following effect, that the function that was looking like this for optimization at the end turns out something to be something like that if you randomly choose subsets of pixels. So the function gets smoother for optimization. Sir?
Can't you use the mutual information, just select the vector in the original picture and then compute the difference between them using the Rodriguez vector representation, and then you can...
But you have the same problem with mutual information. You have to compute the joint density. And that means you have to look what is the probability for the assigned intensities, and you have to go over all the pairs. Yeah. So you do not gain something. But the interesting effect here is that you end up with a smoother data set. And let's look at that.
Why do you end up with a smoother?
Pardon me? That's happening because you're using a different subset. And I mean, when is the similarity going up and down? If you consider all the pixels or voxels, then you have situations where it's more similar, and then you have situations where it's less similar, more similar, less similar. If you use them randomly, the probability that you get a very small value for a perfectly assigned pair of data sets is very low if you have a mismatch. Then you take samples that really do not fit, even if the bones, for instance, fit very well and contribute significantly to the similarity measure. There are some pixels which do not fit. And if you randomly choose them, you have a good chance that you get, you know, representatives that do not perfectly fit. And only in the situation where you have a perfect fit, your randomized process will end up to be very, very small. That's a very, very cool concept. Yeah, and that's also why randomized processes are very, very powerful in medical image processing. I mean, for the patient, it's not a good feeling. If you sit there as a patient and the doctor tells you, now we use a random process, yeah, a randomized search technique to find the optimal match for the diagnosis and for the decision process whether to do a surgery or not. Yeah.
Has this something to do with Monte Carlo?
Yeah, that's exactly the direction, yeah, where you use Monte Carlo type of approaches where you have your randomized component in the optimization process. What are you saying? Give me a second. That's an older talk I gave, but it's expressing things very much and very well. Very well. And you know what? That's very interesting. We had the requirement of the users of the registration module. They wanted to have the result within 5 seconds. And so you cannot address the search space by a grid search, by a traditional grid search. So you have to do something different. And our users, they want to see, like Dieter has shown it in the video, how the one data set is moved to fit to the other one. And at the end of the day, we had an algorithm that was doing it within less than a second, and it was just, yeah? And so we had to slow down the algorithm to have this type of animation that doctors wanted to see, yeah? And you can imagine that we do not do the computations on the CPU, but we use graphics cards, and it was quite an implementation task to build such a system. And having such brilliant people like Dieter, they can do things like that. I would never, ever be able to do that. Here I have an example. Here I have an example of the function to be optimized. That's the mutual information concept, not the SSD concept, but it's basically the same. So if we want to find the optimum of the function, yeah, you can use 10% of the pixels for computing the similarity measurement. If you use 1%, the similarity measure does not change that much. And if you use 0.1%, then you end up with a smoother function if you look at the details, and the maximum is maintained. So you can use just a subset of pixels for computing the transformation. And let me just go back again. Okay. And if you read the literature, you will observe one effect. If you do a registration, either you use MME, mutual information, or SSD, sum of squared differences, what you see is that your objective function has this strange type of behavior. It's going up, and it's going down, it's going up, and it's going down. And in the literature, you find, if you read the older literature 5, 10, 15 years ago, you find comments like, yeah, the objective function is very hard to optimize, and there are all these side minima, and it looks weird, and maybe it's not a good good similarity measure. And what we did is we tried to study why this effect shows up. Yeah? So if you use different optimization routines, different similarity measures, different resolutions, you see this type of high frequency going ups and downs of the objective function. And some researchers concluded that mutual information or SSD are not that good for image registration due to this effect. And we studied this effect, and we were very curious about that, and we wanted to understand what's happening there. And is there anybody in the audience who has an idea what could happen? If you know what happens, it's very intuitive and very clear. But when we started to look at that, we were some kind of surprised and said, where does this come from? We have no idea. And the explanation for that is, I should go for the animation, sorry. I should go for the animation. So on the left side, I will show you the image grids while they are moved. And on the right side, I will show you the mutual information value, or the SSD value. It behaves very similar. So what happens is we have our source image, we have the grid of our target image, and then we move things. And what you see here is interpolation. Go back again. In between the grid points, we have to interpolate, and it makes click where you have a perfect match, click, click, interpolation. So when we do interpolation, we have a low-pass filter. And the high-frequency artifacts you see is basically the interpolation we do in the optimization process. Yeah, it's very clear if you see that. Yeah, so we optimize, and at some point, the assigned grid points don't require that much interpolation. And at some point, or at some rotation parameters, we have to interpolate a lot, so we have a smoother data set. And that's why we have this high-frequency behavior that is due to the discretization of the image. So if you look at the energy function, why we move things, once again, yeah, you see exactly this type of behavior. Yes, sir?
Couldn't we use this because we said we will only use 0.1% of the points?
Yeah.
So couldn't we use exactly those points which are very near the...
Yeah, but that would require a classification of the voxels. So what we did is to solve for this problem. So it doesn't matter what type of similarity measure you are using. That happens also for different interpolation schemes. The behavior changes a little bit, but the overall structure of the high frequency up and downs is maintained. And what Tobias was saying was exactly our solution. What we did is we used a random generator, and we resolved the grid position. Instead of having a regular grid to represent the volume, we randomly choose some points in space and computed their intensity values. Then we took a subset of it, yeah, and used that for interpolation. So this randomized sampling led to the fact that we avoid the interpolation, click scenario. Yeah? And this is a brilliant example where you see how important it is for engineers to have a good intuition what's going on and how the artifacts you get in your problem set are due to the discretization problems, to the setup of your problem, and things like that. So we did this randomized gridding, and we lose by that this regular structure, and by that also the high frequency artifacts in the objective function. And if you now look at, for instance, the objective function to be minimized, here we show the function, the surface of the function in two dimensions, translation in x, translation in y direction. And look how the function behaves. And you see it looks here quite bumpy, the surface. And if we use the trick with the randomized selection of image grid points or image points, we have transformed the objective function from this shape. Let me go back. From this shape, yeah, where you see here you have a side minimum, and here you have a side minimum, here you have a side minimum, and so on. So many, many side minima. And by using the trick with the randomized samples, we get more or less convex function, very smooth. And if you have this type of function, you really jump into the minimum right now. Yeah, cool. And that's a small modification of the code. It doesn't take so much to implement the randomized resampling and the randomized subset selection. And then you end up with an objective function with this type of behavior. And you can imagine if you have a gradient descent method and you start here and follow the gradient, you will be close to zero time in the minimum. And these are all the tricks that we apply to get a practical system up and running. Yeah? So the optimization algorithm, the third step, also very, very important. Let's look at the next example. We want to register a CT and an MR data set. It was very nice when I gave this talk. There were people in the audience who wrote papers about the failure of MMI due to these low frequency structures, and I explained to them why that happens, and it's intuitively clear. It made click in your brain as well, right? You said, yeah, of course, that's where these things come from. And they were also very excited about this. Yeah. If you work on these problems on a daily basis, at some point you don't see things like that anymore because you don't think on this simplified level. Yeah, usually you dig into the math and try to do something smart deep in the math, and you lose a little bit the overview over the problem setup. Good. The first step, define the similarity measure. In this situation, we cannot compute the similarity of assigned intensities. So if I have two volumes that are registered and I take the intensities that are assigned to each other, I cannot say that they have to be similar because I have different modalities. They show different things. Yeah. So I cannot use a difference of the intensities, but I have to redefine the similarity. And our idea on Thursday was, and that's something you have to remember for the future, we look both intensities as random variables and we say we have a perfect match if the statistical dependency of the assigned intensities considered as random measures is as high as possible. Yeah? It's also clear for the physicist. Good. The statistical dependency is as large as possible, so we use the MMI. So we compute the similarity of the image, the source image at position Sij, the reference image at position Ij log P of Sij Rij divided by the product. Okay. Brief remark, if you have P of S I J R I J you have here the pairs of intensities, yeah? And if you want to compute PSIJ out of the joint density, you just marginalize over the possible intensity values here. And you can compute that. So if you have the joint density, you just sum up over all the second arguments and you get the single PDF. And vice versa, you get by integration over the first component, you get the single PDF for the second one. Yeah? So if you have this here, you can compute P of S by using basically the fact that the sum over all Y, P of X and Y is P of X. So the only thing you have to estimate is the joint density, and then you can compute, of course, the components of the denominator. Or what we do in practice, you can also just take the volume and compute the relative frequencies for each intensity, and then you get also the marginals. Yeah. By just counting relative frequencies. So you have volume one, and then you have volume two. Yeah? And then you have your grid here. You have your grid in there. And then you compute the pairs that show up, and you just compute the relative frequencies for each pair. Yeah. So you have your assigned grids, and then you say, okay, these two intensities, they are assigned to each other. So 5 and 7, 5 and 7, and then you count how often does 5 and 7 show up in the whole volume, and then you get the probability for 5, 7 as a pair. Yeah. And if you compute the PDF for intensities of a single volume, you can walk over the whole set of voxels and just count the number of 5s, the number of 7s, the number of 5,000s that show up, and then you divide by the overall number of voxels, and then you have the relative frequencies. Yeah? Hmm?
I just said that we did that in the last
exercise. Oh. Okay. Yeah. Stefan?
Would it make sense when I have these pairs in the histogram that I don't add the 1 to the only cell in the histogram, but apply something like a Gaussian?
Yeah. Yeah, that's for you. That's the natural way to deal with that, to do a Pearson window type of estimator, because you will get a sparse histogram and you just attach to each estimate a Gaussian and look at a Gaussian mixture. But that's something I can't explain within this lecture, because that would require another four sessions. But that's actually how we do it. Good. So we compute the mutual information, and in terms of parametrization, what do we do? See previous example. We use, again, rotation and translation. And in terms of optimization, again, see previous example. And the interesting thing is, if you read the literature up to 2006, 2007, people were writing, we cannot apply gradient-based methods to optimize the mutual information. And then a PhD student from France came up with the idea. No, he just said, I can do it. Yeah? He just computed the derivative by doing the following. If you have a... This is not for the oral exam. Yeah? If you have a discrete PDF like this, what you can do is, what Stefan was already mentioned, you can say, I approximate this by a mixture of Gaussians. And then he just computed the derivative of this mixture of Gaussians and came up with a gradient. And since 2007, people write in the literature, we can use gradient-based methods. Yeah? And before, everybody was repeating, well, relative frequencies, how can you compute a gradient? You can't compute a gradient because these are discrete distributions. Yeah? And then at some point, some fresh thinker came in and said, I don't care. Yeah? I just fit in a continuous function and I compute the derivative. And it changed the registration world. Very interesting. I'm very excited about these things. On the one hand, on the other hand, I'm always frustrated because I think I should have come up with this idea. Cool. So now you understood the basics of rigid registration based on point features, based on mutual information, based on intensity values, based on SSD type of similarity measures. And this type of understanding is sufficient to start to do some work in the field. But as you can imagine, if you really work on this type of problems, writing your own algorithm or algorithms, it's very painful to get something up and running sufficiently efficient and doing a sufficient job for medical applications. And if you also read the literature, and that's the last comment I want to do within this lecture series, if you look into the literature, so let's think about the following. You get hired by a company 5 years from now or 2 years from now, depending on the stage of your career, and your boss tells you, can you implement a registration method based on point features? Then you might say, I remember the lecture, quaternions or whatever, and then you try to implement it. And you implement it and it works well once the point correspondences are known. But then you will easily find out that I screwed you up a little bit, as usual. Yeah, that I screwed you up a little bit or I misled you a little bit because I did a very basic assumption in all the algorithms. And that was that the point correspondences are known. And then you start to work on that, and then you notice, he was saying the point correspondences have to be known. Where the hell do I get the point correspondences from? I mean, you can ask the doctor, but he will not provide all the point correspondences you want to have. And then you start to search the literature, and then you will find out that I was explaining to you algorithms that nobody is using practically or in practice, because the correspondence problem is a crucial problem. And what people do for point-based registration is a method that is called bundle adjustment or ICP. And I will briefly explain to you the ICP algorithm that is of high practical relevance and might show up in your career The ICP, that's the iterative closest point algorithm. At least you should have heard of this. And did you do an exercise on the ICP? No? Oh, I'm not connected to the internet. That would be bad. One second. The ICP. The ICP is required if you do real-world applications for point-based registration. And one research project we have is we try to use surface data of the patient. Yeah? Here you see a typical patient and the surface of a typical patient. That's me. that's me. So we use, for instance, a time-of-flight camera or a Microsoft Kinect, and we measure the surface of this beautiful body here. And we have a CT data set of the same body. We can also compute the surface. And what we want to do is we want to register the two surfaces. So what we What we do is we take the 3D surface points and we have to register them. It's point-based rigid registration. But you can imagine if you have a Kinect, you have, let's say, 5 or 250 pixels in X, 250 pixels in Y direction, and each is a surface point. So we have quite a number of points that you have to register. And the same with the CT data set. And then you want to overlay the two structures, and you want to compute the difference of the surface. And you want to do this automatically. And another example where this is also required is if you have inner organs, for instance, if you have a liver in a CT data set. So think about the following situation. You have a patient that gets a liver surgery. Yeah? So your patient is here on the table. You open the belly and you look at the liver. Okay, and you have a pre-operative data set, where you see also the liver in the CT data set. And what you want to do is you want to use your goggles with a little monitor in, and you want to overlay the CT data set with the structure you see in the human body. And what you do is, or what we do is, we measure the surface of the liver with a Kinect, for instance, and we segment the liver within the CT data set. Remember what Dieter Hahn was saying? He's writing algorithms to automatically detect organs. So you press a button, show me the liver surface. Then the two surfaces are registered. And then you can visualize in the situ, you can visualize the CT data set registered with the surface you see. And then you can, for instance, fade in the vessel structures of the liver. And then the doctor sees when he cuts into the liver where the vessels are below the surface. So augmented reality surgery. Yeah? And that's not future. That's something that is already done in high-tech environments in the surgery suite. Yeah. So what we want to do is we want to merge the data, or if you look into the computer vision community, you want to do the following. You have a Kinect, you have a RGB camera, and they are hooked on each other, and you move the camera, and you capture simultaneously color images and range images, and then you want to stitch things together. Yeah, you can use the 3D data to compute a complete 3D representation of the space. And for that, you also need to compute the transformation in between the point clouds. So the problem we want to compute or solve is you have two meshes, surface meshes with points, and you want to compute rotation and translation such that the two meshes fit on each other, such that the rotated and translated meshes fit to each other. What do you see here, by the way? Can you tell me what you see here? What type of structure? Huh? Spine bone? What else? Any other guess? Stomach? The part where our head sits on? Okay, I give you €1 if you have the right answer. Oh, I lost the euro. Yeah, it's the ear. I owe you €1. Ah, I was sure that you are all on the... What?
You can give it to me in the oral exam. I'm one. €1.
I just think what will happen with respect to my assistant being there, and I give you €1. Oh, you're here. Thank you very much. Here is €1 for you. I mean, the other way around, that's something we practice a lot, you know. it's a motivation for me. I'm kidding. Yeah, that's the ear. We had a project with Siemens Audiology, no longer Siemens. They were sold 2 weeks ago. They are a separate company now, completely separate. And what we were working on was a project where we help them to build individualized audio devices or hearing aids, yeah, Hörgeräte. And that means you take some material and you squeeze it into the ear and you just get a measurement of the inner ear to see how the structure is, and then the electronics is squeezed into some plastics that perfectly fits to your personal anatomy. Yeah? Individualized, personalized hearing aids. And of course, if you have two measurements, you want to register the two measurements, or what we did is we tried to find to which surface fits the current surface that we have in our prototype set the best, like with shoes. Yeah, I mean, if you buy shoes, what you would like to have a shoe that perfectly fits to your feet. Yeah, so what you would want to have is measure your feet and then get the shoe produced. But if you go to the store, you cannot say I'm looking for the perfect shoe, but you tell them I have 43 or 44 or 10 or whatever type of size, and then you take one shoe out of the size clusters. Yeah, and the question is which one fits the best, and this is the question you can answer by using registration methods. You have 10 different anatomies pre-manufactured, and then you can ask what is the current anatomy and which one is the one that best fits to your ear. Yeah, and then you get a better fitting hearing aid. Yeah, so we have point clouds and we want to compute the fit here. And we know how to deal with that problem once the assignments are known, the correspondences, and the question now is how can we solve in parallel the assignment problem and the estimation problem. And there are many, many problems. If you look at surfaces, yeah, how do you compute the similarity of surfaces? Huh? How do you compute the similarity of smooth surfaces? You can, of course, measure the distances in terms of detecting structures in one and the same image and then find the mutual correspondence. And here, for instance, once you have fitted the line, you have here a perfect match. Here you have deviations, but you also can think of the situation that you move it a little bit to the left and then this part fits. Here you have a mismatch and this part fits. And this also tells you, you know, how the objective function will behave with many side minima and ups and downs. Yeah? And if you look at the complexity, I mean, think about the situation. You have n points here and you have m points here and you want to find the perfect match. What is the complexity of the most stupid way of dealing with that? Yeah, so you have m possibilities for this point, you have m possibilities for this point, m possibilities for this point, so you will end up with m to the power of n. So you will have exponential complexity. Yeah, it blows out your mind. So we will now talk about the point to point error metrics, so the similarity measure, and we will then introduce the ICP algorithm, and I will show to you efficient variants of the ICP algorithm in the following. So in terms of transformations we want to consider, as usual, you can look at rotation translation, then you can relax the rotation and say that can be any matrix mapping, any linear mapping, so you get an affine mapping. You can use perspective distortion, and you can also allow for local deformations. And that means you take two surfaces and you deform one surface to make it fit to the other one. And what we limit ourselves to is in the following, the rigid case. And then again, of course, you can look at different application domains. Let's focus on the idea where we have this brilliant brilliant body with the surface and the CT surface that has to be registered. ICP, the iterative closest point algorithm, is very simple, and it was introduced in the early 90s. Now you say it's a long, long time ago. Again, I have to tell you, I mean, I started to come into the field in 1992, yeah, and I could be the inventor, but I'm not. There were three papers that were published more or less in parallel, and that's always happening with very good ideas, that these things come up. You know, the time is ready for this type of idea. The community is just discussing in this direction, and at some point, you know, people fly back from a conference and they come up with very similar ideas, and then these things come up in parallel. Yeah. For me, it's always surprising, you know, mankind for many thousand years was not thinking about this algorithm, and then you publish, and all of a sudden, this idea is published by two others at the same time. Yeah, and you can say 1 year earlier, and I would be the big guy. Yeah, but the community is ready, and many, many discussions at conferences prepare and the situation and set the seed points for these implementation. And the ICP algorithm is very powerful. You can use it not only for point correspondences, but also for line segments, for implicit curves. Can you tell me an implicit curve? An implicit representation of a curve? AX plus BY is T. That's an implicit representation of a straight line in 2D, yeah? Parametric curve, surfaces, and many more. So it has a wide range of applications. So what we are doing basically is a two-step approach. We compute the correspondences between two point clouds according to some mechanism. And then based on these correspondences, we compute the transformation. And then we reconsider the assignment of points and refine the assignment of points and minimize again. That's the iterative process we look at. So briefly, the theory. We have two points, P and Q, yeah? PI and the QIs and N of them. That's exactly the setup we had also in point-based image registration. So we have three, for instance, three-dimensional point vectors. And what we look for is the rotation matrix and the translation vector that transforms the 2D, the two point sets onto each other. And that's the algorithm. That's the algorithm. And you have to develop an intuition for that. So we have two point clouds, and we want to compute the transformation. So what we do first is we do an initial estimate. We do an initial estimate of the transformation. For instance, if you have two point clouds, and it's tiring, I know. Two point clouds, what can be the initial estimate? For instance, you can compute an initial estimate for the translation by computing the center of gravity and the difference of the center of gravity, okay? And what you can do in the second step is you can compute the principal axis of the points and say they have to be aligned and compute the rotation angle that basically aligns the principal axis. That's a good initial estimate without doing any point correspondences and things like that. Yeah? Or you start with just the translation vector and the identity matrix for the rotation if you don't know about the computation of the principal axis. And what do we do then? We transform the point P by the transformation that we have estimated. And then we look at the closest point in Q to the transformed point P. So what does that mean? I have an initial estimate of the transformation. I transform the point cloud P. And now here I have the point cloud P transformed and the point cloud Q. And then I look for each point, what is the closest, yeah? What is the closest point in the other set of points? And assign this to it here. Yeah, I get the closest point in Q to the transformed point P. Of course, if you have a perfect match, you get the right assignment. If you have a mismatch, you get at least the closest points. And you do that for all the points. You get the closest point, and then you transform, you compute the difference between the transformed point and the closest point. Okay? And if this difference is below a threshold, yeah, you set a weight to 1. Otherwise, if it's above a threshold, you say this is not well assigned. And you say 0, it's not assigned. Wrong, it's not assigned. Okay? And then you apply this for all the points, and then you get a binary vector for those points that are well assigned, respectively not well assigned. For those that are well assigned, they are weighted by 1. Those that are not well assigned, they are weighted by 0. And if you look at the objective function here, that means that you now look at a similarity measure where only the points are considered that are well matched. And then you try to refine the estimate of T. Yeah, and then you estimate the T of those point correspondences. And how can you optimize this function here? Well, you select a subset of points. You have a rotation and translation, and you can use the quaternion type of optimization step in here. Then you go back, and again, you take all the points, and you look for the match, how well things are assigned, and you iterate until your method converges. It's a heuristic method. It's not guaranteed to produce the right solution. Yes, please. Yeah, I mean, you are now right into the engineering setup of this algorithm. I mean, you have to be careful in selecting this, that you have at least one point that perfectly matches. So your initialization has to guarantee that at some point you start to initialize it properly.
Same question.
Yeah. I mean, if you don't have a match that falls in the range of this error measurement, then you have a problem. What you can do, for instance, is contract the theta max. You start with a large one, and then iteratively you shrink it. Yeah? So these are heuristics that you can apply. This method does not guarantee that you end up with a correct solution. But in practice, it has to be shown that this is a very powerful approach, and you don't have to fight that much with a correspondence problem of this type of complexity. Yeah? That's in heuristics, but it works pretty well. It works pretty well, the ICP closest point. And I bring this up because this is a very important algorithm, and it's heavily used in many, many, many applications. Okay. Good. I think that was the story. I was a little unfair during the semester, because I have reserved 2 lectures a week with the argument that I can then skip one or the other lecture because I have other appointments. But the trick that I have my lectures from 8 to 10 and no people or not that many people in academia work before 10, I had no appointments scheduled for this time. So we had way more lectures than originally planned. So you get less ECTS compared to the effort you had in attending my lecture. I'm very sorry for that. I'm not sorry for that. I don't care. I hope you enjoyed a little bit the field that I tried to fascinate you off. It's a very challenging, evolving field. Things are changing a lot. I hope that you find the field so attractive that you decide to work with us on a bachelor thesis project, on a master thesis project. And for the smartest guys or for the smartest students, I really encourage you to be present in the lab, and hopefully we can make you an offer for a PhD project, and then you are back into my environment and we can do really cool research and bring some progress to medical image processing, medical image analysis, and this very exciting environment that is very unique here in Erlangen, and also the constellation with industry. It's very unique, and you should really take the chance you get here at our university. And maybe I see one or the other in the summer semester lecture on pattern analysis. I try to teach that. That's an experiment because there are not that many presidents still teaching. Let's see how well that works. For me, it's very important. I was teaching also during my industry career, and I would like to continue, and let's see what's going to happen. All the best for your future, and maybe I see one or the other in the near future. Take care.